Good morning. My name is Glenn Jacob, and today's service is lay-led. Our professional minister is attending, but it is a lay-led service. And in today's call to worship, I'm just going to give a little bit of an introduction of what's happening today. One thing that has come up every once in a while from time to time at our worship committee meetings is, what would we do if there was no service? What if the service leader didn't show up for some reason and we had to put something together at the last minute? Well, many of our committee members are also in SKIT, our improvisational group. And so we always go, ooh, ooh, ooh. I bet we could improvise a service if we had to. So far we have never had to test that theory. But when the worship committee was tasked with planning a service this month, it was brought up that the improv group had not led a service for a long time, and I thought, why not try doing that improvised service? Well, even members of our own group thought that this might not be a good idea. Improvised hymns, and the way that's going to work, as you'll notice in your order of service, the hymns just have a question mark. When the time comes for us to sing a hymn, there are a number of them in a special envelope that our own Reverend Joy has. And I want to thank Marla in advance for being a good sport and going on with our craziness. So a hymn will be selected from the envelope, and we'll sing that hymn. And then same thing later on, we'll have some short homilies, and there's another envelope with homily topics. And when the time comes, a topic will be drawn, and one of us will, on the spot, come up with a short homily on that topic. Well, anyway, one of the objections to this was, it's never been done before. Well, personally, I don't like it's never been done before, generally as an objection not to do something, because by default, you would never do anything new, because the first time you do something, it's the first time. So yes, we do not know how today's service will go. There will be some surprises, and that can make some people uncomfortable. I know just from my own experience, I've met some people who, when there's a doubt about something that's going to happen or something that's being planned, if they're not sure it's going to go over well, they would just as soon not do it. They would just want to squash it and make sure it never sees the light of day. But then there are other people, or I think a lot of people here, hopefully, who enjoy something new or support other people's creative ideas and their willingness to express themselves. So as we gather in about an hour at the conclusion of this service, I fully expect one or two people to come up and say, you know, that maybe wasn't the best idea. Maybe we shouldn't do that again. But maybe there'll be a couple more who'll say, wow, that really worked well. I'm surprised. I even got a little inspired. So whatever happens, we'll accept the decisions of the people. But anyway, as we begin, I just want to say one thing. Have faith. So now I'll ask Reverend Joy to hand me a homily topic from our sealed envelope before this, only known to the accounting firm of Price Waterhouse. I will be speaking for a few minutes about a life-changing personal choice. Okay, I'll go back a few years. I had to make a life-changing personal choice when I was just barely 18. I've mentioned from time to time that when I was much younger, I was very sick. When I was in high school, and this was just perfect for a very skinny, young, shy, not very self-confident young man to have an intestinal disease, which the main symptom was uncontrollable bloody diarrhea. So as a young, not very confident high school person, this was a little inconvenient. And it went on for a while, and I went to many doctors who were trying to figure out what the heck this was. And I know some people here have had colonoscopies, which is never a picnic. But I remember one when they're trying to figure out what this was, where I was, of course, on the examining table in a very uncomfortable position with a telescope jammed up my rear end. And the doctor looking in it and going, "What the heck is that?" And I remember at one point while I was lying there, he actually went to the door of the room, called in a fellow doctor saying, "You've got to take a look at this." And then he looks at this, and the other doctor says, "Well, what do you think is going on there?" And the other doctor says, "I'm not sure." So anyway, they figured it was either Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. And the determination later was most likely it was colitis, but they didn't have the diagnostic tools then that they do now, so they weren't quite sure. So they gave me a bunch of drugs, chiefly a stimulant, prednisone, which in theory would help your body fix itself. At the same time, gave me really bad acne and my hair started to fall out, which was, again, really good for a high school boy. But that wasn't working. So it came down, well, we'll have to go with a surgical option. And then, so we talked about it with my doctor and I said, "Well, what kind of surgical option?" And it's like, "Well, if this doesn't work, your large intestine has got to go. It's ruined. It's chock full of holes." And I said, "Well, that sounds scary. What happens after that?" And it's like, "Well, a lot of the people who go through this have to wear a bag." It's like, "Oh, not at 18. Sorry, no, I'm not comfortable with that." And they showed me what they looked like, and it's like, "I don't think so." And then there was another choice called the Koch pouch procedure, which is K-O-C-H if you're curious, where they take the end of the small intestine and they cut it and sew it into sort of a pouch that's internal, and it leads to the abdominal wall and can be emptied manually. So it's a little, it's still a life-changing thing, and sometimes messy and takes some time to take care of, but better than the bag. So anyway, I've said, "Well, if the current symptoms don't go away or get significantly better in, say, 3 months, I'll have the surgery." And the doctors applauded me for being a brave young man. And so things didn't get better, so I went under the knife. And it's weird because when you're about to have surgery, a lot of people tend to pray at that point. And I never believed in any mystical beings or gods. So I just thought I had to have faith. I had to trust the doctors around me that they knew what they were doing and that I would come out okay. And so anyway, I went through that, and I only have a few minutes. So it was a long recovery process, no food at all for days and days and days, and then just liquid for days and days and days after that. I was dreaming of shrimp plates and all kinds of different things. So two other significant things happened right after that, because it didn't go exactly as planned. Shortly after I came home, things got a little loose, and the bit of intestine that was attached to the inside came to the outside, which happened to me while I was working at the ice cream shop. So it was kind of panicky, going, "Things are really not right down there." And but I tend not to panic. I did the best I could to close up the shop and told my coworker, "We're closing early. I have to go home." And then as soon as I got home, I was, of course, in the bathroom screaming because I've got this thing coming out of me. And so my mom got the doctor on the phone and basically put ice on it and try and shove it back in where it belongs. So finally, that worked, and I ended up going back in for another surgery, and they stapled everything together so that it would stay in place. And then the other significant thing that's worth talking about is my first time of public speaking was right after that, because this surgery was fairly new and they wanted to talk about it with other prospective patients. So they invited me to go to this sort of a conference where doctors and patients, and some of these patients were going to be kids and their parents were there, and try and make them feel good about what was going on. So I don't even remember anything I said. I was kind of nervous and talking on automatic. But at one point I was almost concluding and they were showing slides behind me. And I didn't know what they were showing because I was looking the other way. But I happened to glance back and there was this really big slide of this young man, shall remain nameless, on the table, unconscious, and they were drawing this really long, drippy bit of intestine out of his back end. And it was like, I didn't know they were going to be showing that, and it was horrifying. But I took a deep breath, I turned around, and continued talking. I have no idea what I said. I was kind of talking on automatic. I think I even got a laugh at some point. So anyway, sometimes you just have to hope that things work out for the best, and sometimes they do. Obviously, sometimes they don't. But again, I guess just coming back to what I said at the beginning is sometimes you just have to have faith that things will work out. Thank you.
A man stood by a tall mountain, and as he was walking, the ground gave way, and he slipped and fell. Here he is, hanging on the branch, and he calls out in loud voice, "Please, somebody help me! Is there anybody up there?" And he hears from the back, "Yes, my son, it is I, God. Let go of the branch, and I will catch you." To which the young man thinks for a second and then screams out, "Is there anybody else up there?" That is one way of confronting your fears. However, it's not the only way, thank goodness. The fear that I remember most confronting is my fear of falling. I don't necessarily have a fear of heights. I just have a fear of falling. It's sometimes very difficult to tell the difference between the two, but I have been up in high places where falling was not a problem, and therefore the height was not a problem. I decided a little while ago that fear just has to go, because it kept me from growing as a person. So I went and did something that's rather unique for a person in my particular situation. I went skydiving. Now, I had a couple of friends with me egging me on, so this wasn't a by-myself choice. It was one of those cases where I didn't really want to ruin the party, so off I went. Figured this might be good for me. Well, we all got to this skydiving center. They all weighed us and discovered, "You're over 200 pounds. You have to go first. Because we can't take you up to the full height because the parachute won't work." I said, "Parachute not work." Why am I now worried? They got us all strapped in, and the plane took off. And I'm still kind of wondering, how is it that everybody gets so worked up over the plane being sealed on a commercial jet that here's one with a big gaping hole in it and nothing's going wrong? So they said, "Okay, you're first, Johnson." Now, this was a tandem jump, so that means the person who really knew what they were doing was tied behind me. And I get up, centered myself as best I could, and walked out to the door. And I said, "Okay, on three, one, whoosh!" And, of course, my natural reaction was, "What happened to the two and three?" So, and now he announces that he's not going to pull the ripcord. I am. And my first question is, "Where is the ripcord?" He goes, "It's behind you." And my response was, "That's not good enough. Be more specific." And we're going down and down and down. And finally, I find the ripcord. He goes, now, before you pull it, jerk your head all the way back as far as you can go. Okay? Whoosh! Whoam! Suddenly, we're defying gravity in an opposite direction. Needless to say, I was a little bit wigged out. And he says, now, hold on to these. So I'm holding on to the handles. And all of a sudden, he says, now, here's something special. Pull down on the handles as hard as you can. Whoa! Yeet! And we're dead frozen. Not going up, not going down. And he says, now look around me and tell me what you see. And I looked around, and what I saw was life moving. We weren't moving, but everything else was. You could see the freeway, you could see the trees, you could see the ground. And he says, now, see that little spot over there? And I said, yeah. That's where we're going to land. And I noticed how far away the spot was, and I said, yeah, you're dreaming. He says, no, we're going to do just fine, and you're gonna land us in on that spot. And I went, okay. He says, well, now time to let go, because we've got to get down there. So I let go, and we start moving again. And every now and then he'll whisper something in my ear, and I'll make a turn and float a little closer. When we finally got down, I didn't quite reach the spot. I was about 100 feet off from it. And did it cure my fear of falling? Oh, heck no. But for one brief moment in time, I wasn't afraid and was actually enjoying myself doing something that on my own I never would have done. Now, I still keep away from tall places. Taller than me, anyway. But now I understand that sometimes you can break through your fears and enjoy something that normally you wouldn't have enjoyed. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Thank you.
Value of honesty. Now, unlike my fellow compatriots here, somehow my brain and my mouth are connected to my legs, and that's why I like to move around while I'm speaking. Also gives me a chance to pause and think about this and whether I can really do this. A couple of weeks ago, I had an experience regarding honesty, and it wasn't my own, but I would like to think I would have handled it a little different than the other person. About a year ago, my wife, Diane, was visiting somebody, and she bumped somebody's bumper. And she left a note. It was at night. And sure enough, in the next couple of days, we got a phone call from the person, and we reported it, and we took care of the damage. Well, our insurance company took care of the damage, and then after that, they took care of us. Anyway, we're having some work done at our house, and we're having a lot of workers come and go with trucks. A couple of weeks ago, one of the workers said, I may come back on Saturday morning to do a few things, so we left the driveway open, and I parked on the street with my car that is about a year old and who I've really loved and taken care of and polished and waxed it and cleaned it. Well, I parked across the street on the curb, next to the curb, and on Saturday morning I got up to get the newspaper, and the front end of my car had been smashed. And there was, of course, no note. And I started to think about what is honesty. I may not be quoting it perfectly, and I forgot who said it, but it's something about integrity is what you do when nobody's watching. There's the old story about the person who hits somebody's car and leaves a note, and it says, there are people watching me, so I'm leaving this note, but don't think you're going to get any information off of it, and you'll never hear from me again. But that same person wouldn't have even done that had there not been the fear that somebody was watching. Doing what you do when nobody's watching is what is integrity and what is honesty. Anyway, people that know me know that I'm a person who doesn't let go of things very easily. So what could I do? There wasn't really much I could do. I had the police come and look at it, and they said, yes, somebody hit your car. But then I decided, well, I've got to get this off my chest. So I wrote a letter to our local weekly newspaper complaining about this and talking about my own moral character as opposed to this dastardly person who did this thing to me. And I got exactly what I expected, which was no response whatsoever. Nevertheless, tomorrow morning I'm taking my car in. I will pay my share of the damages. But it made me think a lot about what you do when nobody's watching. And to me, that is how you define your own integrity and your own honesty. Thank you.